and the crowd beginning to pay its tribute to Andretti, the young man who came to this country at the age of 14 as an immigrant from Italy. He had driven racing cars even before he came over here.
What's going on, everybody, and welcome to Collector's Gene Radio. This is all about diving into the nuances of collecting and ultimately finding out whether or not our guests have what we like to call the collector's gene. If you have the time, please subscribe and leave a review. It truly helps. Thanks a bunch for listening, and please enjoy today's guest on Collector's Gene Radio.
This was the one he wanted more than anything else in the world. And here it comes, Mario. The checkered flag of victory. He's done it. And look at this scene in the pit.
Today's guest is none other than the racing legend, Mario Andretti. Widely regarded as the greatest race car driver in the history of the sport, Andretti was born in Italy and didn't emigrate to the United States until age 15. At 19, he began racing stock cars in Pennsylvania, and that was the start of an illustrious career that saw him compete and win in every discipline he entered. He won races in sports cars, sprint cars, stock cars. He won on ovals and road courses and drag strips, on dirt and on pavement. He won at virtually every level of racing since he arrived in America from his native Italy at age 15. His achievements became legendary. The world watched as he won the Daytona 500, the Indianapolis 500, and ultimately the Formula One World Championship, taking home an unprecedented trifecta. No other race car driver has ever won all three titles, and Mario took the checkered flag 111 times during his career, a career that stretched 5 decades and across 6 continents. Today, in his retirement from racing, Andretti is still one of the most respected voices in motorsports and has received hundreds of awards and recognitions, like being named Driver of the Century. He was also knighted by his native Italy, and the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. added him to its Living Legends list. And of course, on the lighter side, but undoubtedly affirmation of his charisma and popularity, he was in the first Pixar Cars movie voicing himself, and GQ magazine named him one of the 25 coolest athletes of all time. So with great honor, this is Mario Andretti, the greatest race car driver of all time, for Collector's Gene Radio. Mario Andretti, what an honor to host you on Collector's Gene Radio today.
Thank you, Cam. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So today's conversation is going to be a bit different, as you're not necessarily a collector per se, but I want to twist the narrative just a bit, as you've collected an incredible amount of wins and trophies over your career. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's 111 is the number. Have you ever looked back at your career and thought of it as a collection of wins?
Well, of course. When I look at my trophy case, I would say I could consider that a collection, because it's what we have, not just race wins. We have other awards that come along, you know, the Halls of Fame and all those things that are incredible that you never even expect to be part of or to win. And, you know, when you look at the magnitude of trophies, because some of the races you're given trophies also if you're on podium. So I have a lot more than 111 trophies in my case.
I've seen the photo. It definitely looks like pretty museum worthy.
Yes, like I said, we could call it a collection, if you will.
What I find interesting is that the mentality and the sentiment of a collector shares a lot of the traits with those who are really successful in a career like yours, where you have the drive and the tenacity to continue to win and add new races under your belts. And I think that is often a comparison that's not usually made, but being a successful driver in your case holds a lot of the same, I guess, elements as someone who's a collector who's constantly going after something and hunting for something and working towards something.
Yes, indeed. Because, actually, as I said, there I'm looking a lifetime, my professional lifetime of work. And no matter what shelf I'm on, it's bringing back, you know, some fun memories for sure, things to reflect on, and different eras, if you will. I've been so fortunate to have been around long enough, dodged so many bullets along the way. So, yeah, it's again, it's amazing, you know, when I walk by, it's just quickly, you know, just I see something, you know, and it's a, and it comes right back, comes, oh, yeah, that's what it was, and so forth. That's what a collection is about, I suppose. So you collect things, obviously, that are important for a reason, and you collect cars, you collect watches, as you say, you know, and that's because you're passionate about something. And in my situation is I didn't really go, okay, I got to have this special one. It just, it happened. and it's a different category, but believe me, satisfaction-wise, I'm right up there.
Spoken like a true champion. I love it. So your love for driving starts, I'm sure, before this, but it really starts to kick in. You're working at a garage back in Italy with your brother. Tell me about the first time you got behind the wheel of a car and the feeling you got, which has propelled you to be one of the greatest racers of our time.
Well, what's interesting, yes, we were, you know, in a refugee camp, and it was inside the city of Lucca, and they, across the square, there was this garage where they were doing, you know, not only repair, but parking as well. So my brother Aldo and I used to, you know, hang out, and we befriended the owners, which, you know, were very gracious. And you know, talking about racing and things, and we couldn't even reach the pedals that put us in customers' Topolino and taught us how to drive in. And then this thing progressed to the owner. Sometimes he would get in a customer car and do burnouts. And that's how I learned to do standing starts, you know. And that's why whenever I go and have, you know, my car valeted, I'm thinking of my days. I said, I wonder if they're going to do to that car what I used to do. And again, one thing led to another. I actually, when you talk about passion, how it all just came to us in such a way that it was the impossible dream, but then, you know, it became a dream that had no plan B, you know, it was only plan A to go after, no matter how impossible. But they took Aldo and I, age 14, to Monza to see the Italian Grand Prix. And at that moment, my idol, Alberto Ascari in a Ferrari, was running. Fangio, Moss, and, you know, Kling, and all of the heroes of the moment. And, oh, my God, I was like in heaven. And again, from there on, I said, okay, dear God, you know, that's the only thing I ask. And but one thing led to another, you know, as we know. But again, that the idea, the pursuit, never changed. No matter what the, you know, obstacles seemed to be along the way, but there was always that shining hope and drive. And along the way, when I reflect on that too, I said, oh my God, what if this would have happened? What if that would have happened? What if that individual would have been there? And so many events, you know, that they go on, and it's almost, you look back, what a miracle this was.
So you eventually moved to Pennsylvania in around the mid-50s, and you and your brother stumble upon a racetrack in your town, in this small little town in Pennsylvania. I would have to imagine it made moving to the U.S. just a little better when you found that.
Oh, Cam, you can't believe it. It's we arrived here on a Thursday in June, and on a Sunday, the following Sunday, you know, Thursday in June, so the racing season was in full-fledged. And we were in my uncle's house, which was right at the edge of south edge of town, and within like a miles away from the racetrack there was, which was part of the fairgrounds. And as the evening comes on, all of a sudden we see bright lights in the background and a big explosion of engines firing up. Oh my goodness! Aldo and I looked at each other, and we didn't say anything. We just followed the sound. We just ran in that direction, and we just peeking through, you know, the fence there, and we see this brute looking modified stock cars, you know, and that's the first time we saw what U.S. local racing was about, because the last cars that we had seen was Formula One cars and the Mille Miglia. We actually, a month before we came to the States, we went to the near Florida, Betone Pass, and watched the Mille Miglia. And I remember Moss coming through with his Mercedes with Dennis Jenkinson next to him, you know, and all that. And but again, you know, but Aldo and I looked at each other and we said, you know what? This looks like it's doable.
Well, you actually enter your first race and you don't tell your parents about it. Is that right?
No, actually, we drove the entire first season without, I think my mother, and we never told her explicitly, but, you know, moms always know. And, you know, we had only been in the States for 4 years, basically, when we started racing. So my mother was quicker in you know, in the English, picking up the English. But my dad took a lot longer for him. So that was the buffer that we had, you know, the language barrier, if you will. And we didn't dare tell him because I know that his reaction would have been a natural reaction of any parent, you know, that wants their kids to be safe, because he was not a race fan, but all he knew was about the fatalities. Like my idol, Alberto Scotti, was killed just a month before we left. We come to the States, you know, testing, you know, for Sebring in Monza. And there were fatalities upon fatalities in those days. And on a ship, Conte Biancamano, on the way over, they had a bulletin board every day of news coming on around the world. And that was the weekend of the 24 Hours of Le Mans. And wouldn't you know, that's the one that where Pierre Levesque wound up in the grandstands and killed 85 people, 85 spectators. So news like that, that was, and then, you know, again, we arrived here in 1954, Bill Vukovich, you know, who somehow it rang a bell for even my dad, was killed at Indianapolis. And that's all he knew. That's all he knew of the downside of the sport. And there's no way, as far as he had the ability to stop us, they would have let us go. My dad, even at work, you know, because we won races locally right away. Matter of fact, Aldo and I both, we won the first race that we competed in. And I couldn't, and that's a matter of record, by the way. You know, we have newspapers to back it up.
Well, I don't think anyone's second guessing you.
But my dad at work, his boss would say, "Oh, Gigi, oh, your boys are really doing well." He had no idea what he was talking about. So he thought that he was being, you know, just.
Amazing.
Yeah, he started saying about his work or something.
Right.
Complimented about that. Anyway, he didn't know until the very last race of that season. It was an invitational, and Aldo actually had a big accident where he was given his last rites that night.
Oh my gosh.
In Hatfield, Pennsylvania, yeah. And it was our car, but I was driving because of an invitational. We had a good season because the invitational, you had to be top three in the points in racetracks within 150-mile radius. And we raced everywhere there, and we qualified for this invitational. And as you know, we used to alternate. He would drive one weekend, I would drive the other weekend. So we still earn enough points. And I got a ride with somebody else, with another gentleman from Allentown, and Aldo drove our car. And the last lap of a qualifying heat, when he was running, he was qualified for the feature in second place, and he was trying to pass to overtake the track champion there, which he didn't need to do, because the top four qualified for the event at that point. And he just hit the guardrail and went end over end over end over end, and came away with a fractured skull. And he was in a hospital for over a month. So
scary moment.
Yeah. And that's how my dad found out.
Well, you guys kept it a good secret for a good amount of time. It unfortunately took a situation like that, but that's pretty impressive.
The standings, Mario Andretti, far out in front.
So racing really starts to take off for you And I'm curious to know, at what point did you really see it as a career?
Well, I was thinking of it as a career immediately, you know, but again, you have to be realistic. And also, you know, I had a young family, meaning I married young, you know, 2 years later, 21, I married, and I figured, well, now I have another responsibility. And I never had really a totally 100% job. I had like somewhat, somehow I put bread on the table, you know, just from the beginning. It was a bit stretched and so forth, but things were just happening. You know, I had bumps on the road, if you will, but somehow it just came out on the other side. As I said, when I reflect, there's certain events. What if this one have happened? What if that one have happened? And my wife's dad and his partner, I talked them into buying a midget, which was a very famous three-quarter midget, so I could drive in the wintertime in the indoor, and that's where the some of the owners of the full-size midget used to scout for talent. Sure. And the first year that I won the biggest race, the 100-lapper in Teaneck, New Jersey, and the driver that finished second to was Len Duncan, who was one of the top. He was one of the top midget drivers in the East at the time, and he was actually a legend in midgets. And so it's a long story about that and how he didn't spin me anyway. but that event gave me a ride, full-size midget, with one of the top teams and started winning. So it, basically the process was I was going through the ranks, and as soon as I would win, you know, in one category, I would not make a career that I wanted to move to the next level, next level, next level. And it was until, you know, I started in 1959, and by 1964, and then 64 later in the season, I was invited to test a champ car, which was the top level. It was the Indy cars. And then we were with one of the top three teams there was at the time, the Dean Van Line team that, you know, actually that's the team that gave Foyt the first test at Indianapolis. Sure. And but their driver, Chuck Halls, was killed in one of the sprint car races, which actually I was in. At that time, I was driving sprint cars. And I had won some race. In fact, I won the Salem 100, you know, with Foyt, and all the top guys were in there, and I won that. And so I was invited to test for a drive on that car. But believe it or not, there were a couple of us, and the other gentleman, the other driver that was invited was Roger Penske. He was a driver, and he was a favorite to go. So I said, okay, if something happens, and sure enough, he had a business commitment somewhere, so he couldn't do it. So I was invited in Trenton, New Jersey. There was a Firestone tire test, and there was my car, well, us with the Dean Van Lines, and there was Parnelli Jones and Roger Ward were the two other drivers that were actually doing the proper testing. And so I'm driving along and so forth, and I'm doing my job. And they put some test tires on my car after a while, you know. And the engineers liked the immediate feedback that I was giving, because they said it was, you know, it was so, they called it, it was an honest feedback, because sometimes the veterans tell the engineers what they want to hear. You know, I learned later on, you know, they said I was brutally honest. You know, sometimes by brutally honest, you're offending some engineers, because they think right. They have, you know, the latest and greatest. And the situation, you know, went from there. So then I entered a couple of races. I had one podium in Milwaukee, and the following year, the full season in IndyCars was 1965. And there, you know, I was rookie at Indy. I finished third behind Jim Clark and Parnelli Jones. And then, and I won the national championship that year, my very first year full time in IndyCar as I won a national championship. So
incredible.
Things couldn't have been any better from, you know, as far as how do we go forward, you know. So following that, 65, 66, 66, I won another national championship. And that's without getting a single point at Indianapolis. 67, 68, I finished the closest second in points ever. And I lost the championship on the very last race on both years. And 69, I won Indy, I won a championship. But in between, like in 67, you know, I won Sebring with Bruce McLaren, you know, with the 4 to 12 hours. I had already done, you know, 24-hour Daytona in 66. And then in 68 was my first opportunity in Formula One with Colin Chapman. And I asked to do the last couple of races here. It's a long story, but I'll just go fast forward. It was the last race was the Watkins Glen. And I never seen that place. You know, I had only tested a couple of weeks before at Monza. So I was somewhat familiar with the car and I loved it. And I put the car on pole, you know, and my very first race, Formula One race. And what put a caveat to it was that Jackie Stewart was next to me, world champion, you know, so. And, you know, my teammate, Graham Hill, was fourth, you know. So these are things, again, that you can only dream about.
Mario Andretti is running away with the 1969 edition of the Indianapolis 500. If his car will just hold together for a few more laps, he's got it wrapped up.
Yeah, I mean, each year as your career progressed, I mean, things just got better and better and better and more races won. And that's why you are recognized the way that you are today. You've had so many wins and accomplishments in your career that we could easily spend all day talking about them, probably 3 days. You're considered one of the most versatile, if not the most versatile, drivers of all time. I mean, everything from Indy 500, Daytona 500, more than I can count on two hands in F1, and so many more. Many athletes talk about the importance of visualizing success before achieving it. Did you have any rituals or mental strategies for collecting all these victories on the track?
No, not really. I approached one thing that I know and it worked for me. I approach every single race the same way. It's not that, you know, because you're going Le Mans, you're going to Indianapolis, one of, you know, races that are obviously non-fans, you know, the rest of the world is focuses on, you think, you know, you have more pressure. If you think you have more pressure on that one, then you're not doing your job on the others. And sure. I'll give you, for instance, I remember just, you know, the first, one of the years at Indy, I'm at the hotel and I come back from dinner, it's around 10 o'clock or so, and they said, Mario, shouldn't you be in bed? This is Indy 500 tomorrow. I said, yeah, I know. I said, usually I don't go to bed until 11 or so, and for any of the races. I prepared exactly the same for every single, whether it was a major race in a sense, but, you know, like physically and everything else, but the mental preparation was the same. And even like if you go back and the way I look, you know, basically, if you have a mindset, in other words, if you analyze the situation too deeply going in, like you say, oh man, sometimes realistically, you don't have a chance in hell, you think to win that race that day. But you can't say that to yourself. You cannot accept it. You know why? Because so many other things can happen. And, you know, by hook or crook, you might pull that off. And I've done that. It's happened.
Sure have.
So always keep your mind, you know what? This can be a good day today. It's going to be a good day. And you got to go in, I think, with that mindset. I think it's imperative you do that. Sometimes you can over-engineer yourself. And I've seen even some drivers sometimes, you know, I won't give you any names and so forth, but it's been close to me. And they analyze the situation too deep and they're defeated before they start. You have to be a dreamer. You know what I mean? You have to say, no, I'm going to, something's going to happen. You know, just
right.
the hook or crook, as long as you're there, you know you have a chance.
Was there a favorite car or team that you were on that you share your fondest memories with?
Yes, of course. I mean, it's of course, when it comes to cars, are the ones that brought you a win. You know, you fall in love with those cars. I mean, because everything was right. And the teams have been, you know, so fortunate again to have just a fantastic relationship, you know, let it be with the Dean Van Nine, with the group that when I started, I mean, we won a lot of races, and we won 3 championships, 2 second place before we split up. And then I go back and I go back to my relationship with Vals Parnelli-Jones, my relationship with Paul Newman and Carl Haas. 12 years after I came out of Formula One, you know, we won a national championship. We won 18 IndyCar races. A team that, you love everyone around you. The experiences, you know, depend on the era or the period, you know, it's figure. This is the best. Oh, yeah, next one. Oh, yeah, this is the best.
Sure. They're all the best.
They're all the best when you win.
You have a family legacy full of racers and drivers now, and I say this for all intents and purposes. As a collector of all these races and trophies, how special is it for you to pass down your legacy to a family of successful and talented drivers as well?
There's so much pride in that. You have no idea. I mean, how much I have the appreciation for that and the experiences that we have had as a family. Like, I mean, I go back to Michael and I, for instance, just that in an IndyCar, we were on podium, father and son, 15 times in an IndyCar race.
And unheard of.
We started first and second on front row 10 times. And it was 5-10 in first and second 5 times. As a family with Michael, Jeff, my younger son, and nephew John, we were the only time before or since 91 and 92 of 4 members of the same family to qualify for the Indy 500. Michael and I were on podium at Le Mans 83. I drove with Michael, Jeff, and myself in the 24 Hours of Daytona. Michael, nephew John, and myself drove for Porsche in 1988 at Le Mans. In 1986, the Pocono 500 had a supporting event like the Indy Lights now. And my younger son, Jeff, was driving the supporting event. And he was on pole for that race, and he won that race. Michael was on pole for the 500, and I won the 500. I mean, did the family celebrate that evening? Yeah. you know what I mean? Moments like that, no one could appreciate that but us. And that's what, you know, motorsport gave us, you know, and there's some others, you know, and, you know, it was a full Andretti podium in 1992 in Milwaukee. You know, Michael won, nephew John was second, I was third. You know, things like that. How could you ever dream that something like that would happen as a family? So you can see on both sides, not everybody has had the success that, you know, some of us did, but we're all in it. We're all with the same passion. And there's 4 on each side. We're a third generation going on both sides, my brother's side and mine.
Amazing. Beyond the physical trophies themselves, what do you consider to be the most valuable collectibles, if you will, from your racing career? Is it the memories, the lessons, the personal growth within the family?
Yes, I mean, like I said, you look at the trophies, how you put value. I mean, it's special events like, of course, Indianapolis, you know, that those are, you know, the most celebrated world championship. There's a trophy, national championship trophies, you know. I have 4 of them. I have even IROC championship trophy. I have a dirt track championship trophy, you know. Those are the ones that the culmination of successful you know, season, if you will, then there are the races. You know, there's certain races that bring just a special moment, a special memory. You know, winning Long Beach, you know, winning, for me, it was something very special in 1977, that, you know, that's a feather on any Formula One driver's cap to win your country's Formula One race. Obviously, it's something special. Sure. And that 77, I won the U.S. Grand Prix at Long Beach. And later that year, I won my native Grand Prix in Italy, Monza, the Italian Grand Prix. And that same year, now, can you imagine? I'm the only one that can appreciate that. But right. You see, I look at those trophies, I said, oh, man, you know, you feel like, you know, just hugging them and kissing them. You know what I mean? It's just it's, yeah. That's the value that I see in my trophy case.
This huge crowd getting ready to welcome Mario as a champion.
Sometimes your trophies are actual trophies. Sometimes they're watches and other ephemera. You've been inducted into multiple Hall of Fames, named United States Driver of the Year in three different decades.
I'm going to stop you right there. I'm in the Hot Wheels Hall of Fame.
Well, how do you beat that? That's tough to beat. You were Driver of the Century. You were awarded the highest civilian honor from the Italian government. I mean, the list goes on, and it's no doubt this has shaped your career as one of the most successful. But behind the legendary racing career and public persona, there's a personal journey that many fans might not be familiar with. Can you share a moment or experience from your life of outside of racing that had a profound impact on you shaping the person that you are today?
Well, I think when I look back in my life, you know, on a professional side, I look at how much help I've had along the way from my family. Take my wife, for instance. I look back and so many things along the way you take for granted, but how helpful it was for her to just make me feel like she's supporting me no matter what. And we went through some moments and times where, you know, she could have been in a way, say, Mario, how about us? You know, and I know that I was very selfish in many ways because I was trying to satisfy my, you know, my, you know, ambitions in the worst possible way. But, you know, and she always had support. Whether I came back with a trophy or not, I had the same embrace and so forth. And I see how important, that's the one thing that the most probably important part overall in my life, if you will. And I look back and what if it would have been the person that said, thinking, Mario, think about your kids and so forth. You know, maybe you should be able, you should spend more time with them. And think about that as well. And I look back at how important. I'll give you a quick story too.
Sure, would love it.
Michael was about it was kindergarten, about five or six. I think it was five, and the teacher was asking all the kids, "What does your dad do for a living?" And the kids said, you know, this and that, and comes to Michael, says, my dad goes to the airport and makes bread. And so the teacher was a friend of mine and said, put that one together for me. and that's what it was, that I was always with a suitcase in my hand and going somewhere. And Michael, one point, he says, Dad, where are you going now? I said, I gotta go to the airport and make the bread. And so to him, I was going to the airport making bread.
Mario Andretti, the airport bakery worker. That's too funny.
Amazing. I keep doing that, by the way, even now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Someone has to, right?
I'm doing that. That's amazing. Next week.
I love it. Before we wrap it up with the Collector's Gene Rundown, everybody wants to know, what is the car that Mario Andretti, racing legend, takes to the grocery store every week?
Well, it depends. It could be my Lamborghini Aventador or my Z06 Corvette. It could be my Ferrari Quattroporte. My Maserati Quattroporte. I'm sorry. Or my Mini Cooper, John Cooper works car, which could be my favorite.
That's fun to drive around.
That is awesome little car. Yeah. The way it's equipped and so forth is fun.
This is the scene in the closing moments. The white flag, one lap for Mario Andretti.
All right, Mario, we can answer these questions based on mainly your racing career, and you know, we'll try and relate it to collecting where we can. All right, sound good?
Very good, yes.
All right, what's the one that got away? So this could be a race or a trophy that got away from you.
Well, if it's races, there's so many. I mean, it's the ones that get away is what? I mean, could have won, you know, it was a shoo-in to win Indy again, you know, in 87. I led every single race. Every single lap and so forth. I was lap and a half in the lead. I already made my last stop, and the valve spring broke. The engine let go, in 77, there are three races that could have meant the world championship by just finishing where I was. And I was in the lead. Two, I ran out of fuel. And the other one, there was a lap in the lead at Mossport. And on the last lap on Australia, the engine blew up. And I almost got to the finish line, and then I pushed and I finished sixth instead. If I had won that, it would have been a world championship. So, like I said, you asked for one. I give you three of them.
It's hard to imagine someone with over 100 wins, but I get it. All right, the on-deck circle. So what are the upcoming events or racing-related initiatives that has you excited?
Well, we have obviously what is already on the schedule with Michael. I mean, I'm looking at Michael's involvement in all the categories, all the disciplines, you know, IndyCars, of course, and he's delving into sports prototypes now, you know, with Wayne Taylor. He's delving into stock cars, you know, NASCAR. And what's exciting also is that my grandson, Marco, is going to be, he's getting into NASCAR. He's going to be driving some truck races, and he's going to be next week, he's going to be in Daytona driving an ARCA car for the ARCA race on Saturday. And that's a new experience for him. And from my standpoint, where I am, you know, talk about looking forward to things.
How great is that?
Yeah, how great is that? Exactly. And he's very excited, by the way, for this different page in his career, new page. And so I'll be riding with him on his shoulder and pulling on his ear.
I love it. How about the unobtainable? So maybe this is a trophy to a race that maybe doesn't exist anymore, or a piece of racing memorabilia that you'd love to own that's just unobtainable.
Well, it's the trophies that the ones that I loaned. I'm going to tell you, I loaned 8 Formula One trophies that I will never get back. Can you imagine that? 8 Formula One trophies. I loaned them, and I'm not going to tell you to whom but somehow I will not get them back.
Ah, that's unfortunate. Well, if we could put into the ether out there to help get them back anyway.
And there, I know where they are too. But
we got to find a way. we'll get a squad together.
Yeah.
The page one rewrite. So if you weren't a race car driver, what would you have liked to have done, and what would you have liked your career to be?
no question, I would have pursued the career of a fighter pilot.
I could see it.
Yes. I said that one time. It was, we were in Cleveland, and ESPN had a question of the weekend, and that was that. I said, well, it might have been your alternate career. I said, there, I'm a fighter pilot. And the following Monday, I got a call from General Creech, who was TAC commander in Washington. And he said, Mario, you have no idea. He says, what that meant for our pilots. And he invited me on to on a ride on an F-16. And I was testing in Phoenix to Florida. We did mid-air refueling and everything. And I flew the airplane. Just an amazing experience.
You didn't probably make your dad too happy when you gave him the two choices of careers that you wanted. either racing or fighter pilot.
Yeah, that's right.
That's funny. How about the GOAT? So what other racing legends did you look up to when you were getting your career started?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I looked up at, you know, the likes of, as you can see, that I've never met, however, at the time, but met the family, Alberto Ascari, Moss. Moss and I became actually good friends. I had the opportunity when I was in Argentina to spend time with Sterling Moss and Juan Fangio, and they were fascinated as to how much I knew about their careers. He said, these young lads out there don't even know who we are. You know, they were saying, and I knew everything. And so we befriended from then, and Sterling and I, you know, we just, every time, it was a very warm friendship that we had because of that. I go way back. And, you know, not only in the past, but as you can imagine, just present individuals, A.J. Foy, Jackie Stewart, you know, were, you know, they were, to me, the guide to or the ultimate level of performance to be able to achieve, you know, when I broke into, say, IndyCars or later Formula One, and we developed a friendship that, you know, it's very, you know, it's there forever, you know, it's very precious.
Hard to beat the importance of that, of, you know, making relationships with the people that you're also competing against or look up to. You know, especially as someone who, you know, joined pretty young in their career and started kind of reaping the benefits pretty early on.
Those are the ones that that make you work hard and make you a better person, better driver, because if you feel you're going to go anywhere, that's the level that you have to achieve. And because of that factor, I know I'm the one that appreciates how good those individuals were at their trade, at their profession. And you have the ultimate, utmost respect for that.
The hunt or the ownership? So did you like winning the race more or driving in the race more? And I think I know the answer.
Winning.
Easy. Easy answer. Most importantly, and let's answer this based on all of the wins that you've collected throughout your career, do you feel that you were born with the collector's gene?
Probably. Why not? You know, if you're ambitious, that's where you go for, you know. And again, I always, for some reason, I always felt that you have to go for the clouds, you know, and you have to have that mindset, and that's the only chance that you have in achieving, you know, some of what seems to be impossible, what is your ultimate dream.
Amazing. Mario Andretti, thank you so much for joining me on Collector's Gene Radio today. It is truly such an honor and a pleasure for me to have had you on.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure, Cam. Thank you very much for having me.
All right, that does it for this episode. Thank you all for listening to Collector's Gene Radio.